Dr. Aaron Carroll is here. We missed him last week, but we generally talk to him on Wednesdays in the third hour of the program. He's a professor of pediatrics and director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism at Indiana University. He's an author of two books that debunk myths about your health and your body called Don't Swallow Your Gums and Your Gums. Don't Swallow Your Gums. That's referring to me. My gums are so big. If I swallowed them, it'd be terrible. I could choke. And also, Don't Crush Your Eyes. And he blogs at The Incidental Economist. He's a contributor to the New York Times Upshot now and makes videos that go viral every single time on his YouTube channel, Healthcare Triage. Dr. Aaron Carroll is here, and we're always excited when you join us to talk about Dr. Oz.
Bah, great. Look forward to that.
We do have to talk about Dr. Oz.
Okay.
And you've been on the show. You guys are very good friends.
Well, the former is true. I don't know about the latter.
When was the last time you guys got together?
I think the last time I was on his TV show, God, it had to be like 2010 or 11. So it's been a few years.
I got some audio here, I guess.
Of me and him?
Of you and him talking about how good of friends you are.
Oh, good luck. Let me hear that. I want to hear that.
Hey, it's me, Aaron. Hey, Aaron, it's me, Oz.
I'm friends with Bane.
Why was he, what was he testifying about? Do you know any of the background of this?
Yeah, I mean, he, in the last few years, he's more and more sort of lent his name to these sort of like miracle cures. You see them, do you ever get those emails? I mean, I get spam all the time, I assume everyone does. You know, like Dr. Oz touts miracle cure, this or that. Well, I guess some kind of like green tea extract or something along those lines, you know, they were saying, like, you'll miracle weight loss, you'll lose tons of weight, and he was lending his name to it, and saying in ads that, like, it's, you know, it does this, or it works, or it's proven, I don't know, and Congress is getting upset, because the FCC, I guess, has been, or the FDA has been pretty lax on sort of allowing these kinds of advertisements, even when they're not technically true, and so they were sort of cracking down or having a hearing, I guess, to sort of say to him, why are you doing this? Like, why would you do this? I guess some of them are even incredulous. Like, it's not like you're not big and rich and powerful and respected. Why would you do this? And he was defending it to the best that I guess he could.
Do we have the audio? I thought we had it. All right, well.
That's some crack show you got there.
Yeah, I thought we had it. Sorry. We'll come back to it because I just think that, well, it was weird what he was saying. He basically admitted that he knew these things were no good. But, of course, it won't destroy his credibility, and I'm sure his show will go on.
Well, I mean, but he has always skirted the line. Or I shouldn't say always. He sometimes does skirt that line. Like, you know, he said things, too, which get very close to, like, you know, endorsing problems with vaccines or you know, sort of touting cures. Even when I've interacted with him, like, there are sometimes when I think he says things where there's absolute scientific proof, and then sometimes he says things which just don't, that I would almost be like, well, that's a myth. But he says them both with the same conviction, and I'm not even sure belief.
Did he wear his scrubs when he testified yesterday? He always wears his scrubs.
I don't believe he did.
Studio television show, he's wearing
not
scrubs.
Not always. He doesn't always wear his scrubs.
Oh, he doesn't.
TV show, but he does a lot. As if he just rushed in from surgery.
He got me really, he taught me a lot about my poo.
About your poo?
Yeah.
Well, did he teach you what's correct, or did he just...
a nice S shape.
All right, well, that actually is, I think, endorsed. Although, again, I would argue, I don't even know if there's studies. But okay, fine. Okay, great. Very good.
Just wanted to say poo.
Okay.
Thank you, Chris. Okay, so I wanted to talk to you about, well, a bunch of things. Now, we always welcome callers on health and health policy and health insurance. We always take a lot of calls, so light them up, folks. 866-994-6343, 866-99-INDY. Wow, there goes the voice, huh? So, excuse me, whooping cough is back, and it's being blamed on people not getting their kids vaccinated or getting boosters for those vaccinations. How much truth is there to that? What is whooping cough?
It's a bad infectious disease that's a respiratory disease that used to be much, much, much more common. You know, back in like the 1800s or even the, I could probably be even only 1900s. I mean, it was very common and people died of it. But we came with a vaccine and we got it to where it was nearly eliminated. But, you know, just getting yourself vaccinated is sort of the first step to preventing disease because no vaccine is 100% effective. So it certainly improves your chances, but we also rely on herd immunity and the fact that this won't be sort of alive enough in the community for people to get the chance to get infected. And it's cropping up again. It seems to be cropping up a lot in spots where more and more people are sort of refusing vaccines. And this is what happened. This is one of those where I, you know, it's very hard sometimes. It is my inclination to roll my eyes and I'll get yelled at. But, like, you know, the vaccine prevents the disease. If people don't get the vaccine, the disease comes back and then everybody acts all shocked. Yeah. That's what happens. And so it's horrible. The worst part is that it's often the people who cannot protect themselves who are at most risk. We can't protect very, very small babies, cannot get, you know, the full complement of shots until they are a certain age because we have to space them out and we have to, like, you know, wait until they're at least babies. And they are the ones who are at most risk when they get infected with the disease, as are the immunocompromised, people who have, you know, immune systems which aren't functioning well, be it because they are on therapy for cancer or because they have chronic diseases or because they are getting older. And they are at more risk for serious illness. And often those people can't get vaccinated or the vaccines don't work in them. You don't just vaccinate yourself to protect yourself. You vaccinate yourself to protect those that you love who can't protect themselves. And they are at most risk. And you know, we've had this discussion before. Like, it's hard to be sort of dispassionate and calm about this. Like, what are we supposed, you know, what more do you say? What more can you do? It's just there are people who just absolutely believe that they're not at risk or others aren't at risk or these diseases aren't that big a deal or that there's some conspiracy or that, you know, they can just, they're making an individual decision that only affects them and themselves. And almost all of that just isn't true. But so what do you do?
How much of the return of whooping cough can we blame on the anti-vax crowd?
Well, again, it's like there's not going to be a randomized controlled trial of this because we're not going to not vaccinate people to see like what the difference is. But the epidemiologic data is somewhat compelling in that in the areas where sometimes vaccine people who refuse vaccines in higher numbers get the disease. Plus, we can do afterward studies, and we can look at when we have outbreaks, we can look at, hey, what percentage of the people that got infected were not vaccinated versus were vaccinated, and does that correlate with the percent of people that are vaccines? And in almost every single case, it turns out that people who were not at vaccine, who didn't get vaccinated, got the disease in much higher numbers and in much higher percentages than the people who were vaccinated. So they themselves are more at risk. And given that, you know, they were the ones that got the disease, it's very likely that they were the focus or the locus of where the herd immunity broke down. And so can you say 100%? No. Can I say, like, they caused this? It's their fault? It's hard to do that. But the epidemiologic data is somewhat compelling. And also the, you know, just flat-out scientific rationale. Sometimes when we do studies, we forget that, you know, one of the first principles of the scientific theorem is that there has to be an explanation for why this led to that. And in this case, we've got a perfect one because we've already studied the other direction. Giving vaccines makes people much, much, much less likely to get the disease. That's causal. That's been proved in randomized controlled trials. We know that this is the case. So it makes perfect, utter sense that the opposite is true. Where people don't get the vaccines, they are more likely to get the disease. And so there has to be some level of that, I got to imagine.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll. If you have a question, you should call us if you're listening live. 866-994-6343, 866-INDIE. You can follow Aaron on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll. Let's go to Jason in Boston.
Hey, guys. So let's see where to start here. A bit of a personal issue that I've been dealing with over the past months with a family member that has a diagnosed history of mental illness, absolutely refuses to get any treatment, has been bouncing around from police department to psych ward, always being let go without any imminent threat to herself or others. And I guess as a kind of general question, but also connecting it to some recent events with the Santa Barbara shooting, I just wanted to get a doctor's take on how do we evolve from something that's traditionally really hard to kind of balance personal privacy versus getting people the help that they need, even when they themselves can't recognize the need?
Yeah, I mean, that is always intention because we are very much interested in protecting people's autonomy as well as protecting, you know, everyone else's interests as well. That's part of America. And that's not even just in medicine, it's just in much of our politics, is where does everybody's individual freedom end and where does everybody's sort of collective need begin? And so this is, unfortunately, a terrible but real area that people have to deal with, where you believe that somebody is not doing something in their best interest, and we allow a fairly large amount of that. We let people, you know, eat things which aren't healthy to them, and I'm not arguing we shouldn't, just get me wrong, but it's like what I'm saying, we're just trying to give you the lead up. We let people eat things that aren't healthy for them. We let them engage in activities that aren't healthy for them. We let them refuse therapies that we know are beneficial for them. They cannot take the drugs that will help their high blood pressure. They cannot take the drugs that will help their cancer. And because there's trade-offs in all of these things, and people make decisions, and unfortunately it also happens with respect to mental health. You know, sometimes people don't want to take the drugs because the side effects can be massive. They can change the way that they think or feel, or you know, they can make their lives, they feel, less good, and so therefore they don't want to take them. And the problem gets even more complicated with respect to mental health because people sometimes, we can question whether they are competent to be making those decisions. Like, we don't let children, you know, decide not to take their medication when they need it. We tell them to take that. You know, if your kid has an ear infection and they were prescribed antibiotics, parents will make their kids take the antibiotics. They will not allow them to refuse. And many times we have to make similar decisions about people who are mentally ill, whether they are competent or, you know, have enough sort of wherewithal to make those decisions for themselves. Sometimes they don't. And in those cases, we have to go to the courts and we have to, you know, petition for guardianship and for their rights to be taken away. And it's important to understand that's what we're actually talking about, taking their rights away so that other people can make decisions for them. And that's hard, especially with respect to family members. And the courts often err on the side of providing people with the ability to make decisions for themselves. And I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows, what the right answer there is. This all goes away the second a person is either a threat to someone else or a threat to themselves. And so the law is clear that if somebody is going to hurt themselves and has declared it, and there's, you know, reasonable belief that they're going to hurt themselves or hurt others, then the state can step in, and then other people can step in and make decisions for them. But it's much easier to identify that after the fact than before.
That's always the big challenge we battle with now, and the conversation I've been having repeatedly is, right now, collectively, we're all waiting for something horrible to happen.
Right.
Like that type of terrible event that it's coming. It's going to happen. And in the meantime, everybody just says, you know, we're really sorry.
Is this family member plugged into, like, you know, help, at least in an outpatient way? Because, I mean, that at least, if the person's seeing a therapist or talking to someone, if they declare, I mean, they don't have to, like, have a gun, but if they declare, like, I'm going to hurt someone or I'm going to hurt themselves, or, if somebody gets the belief, you know, if a physician or if a psychologist or if a psychiatrist or, you know, hears them declare that, then everything kicks into motion. So it's important to sort of keep them plugged in so that there is the chance to try at least hear a declaration. Because remember, if they're truly mentally ill, they're not going to be calculating this. They're not going to be thinking like, well, I want to kill somebody, but I'm not going to tell anyone because then I'm going to get away with it. Because that's not how the mentally ill think. And so there's, you know, if they're plugged in and they are truly mentally ill, and there's something that someone can do, it is very possible that they will, you know, declare or ask or have a cry for help or acknowledge that they're having thoughts about killing someone or killing themselves, and then everybody can step in. So the best that you really can do is to make sure that they continue to be, you know, aware and, I mean, plugged in, and that people are monitoring them, and that they have continual touch with the healthcare system.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's not the case. We've got a family member that absolutely refuses, and in her head has never been healthier, and things have never been more clear, and everything else before was a fog. So,
sorry to hear that, Jason.
Hard. Yeah, it's very hard, and I wish I had a good answer for you, but it's just, I don't. I wish I did.
Well, welcome to my life for the past 2 months. So,
sorry about that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for listening. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Keith in New York. Keith?
Hey there, Dr. Cat. So I had a question for you because we're on like the same page with vaccines, obviously. Everyone should get them. But I hear a lot from people that, you know, it seems to be, oh, I'm not going to get them. And if I get measles, you know, I'll take whatever the antibiotic is and then it'll be gone. Can you speak to a little, because my wife had, while she was in utero, her mother had whooping cough, and it seems to have given to like a lifelong immunocompromised system. Like, what are the effects that people have for the rest of their life when they get these communicable diseases and don't have the vaccines ahead of time? Because it's not just, you know, you survive or you die. Like, these things have lifelong effects.
You can, but I think that they're actually now starting to recommend that that the elderly or people above a certain age actually get boosted, especially if they're going to be around infants, because I think we're noticing that some of these diseases are coming back, and so requirements and recommendations are changing all the time. If you have most of these diseases as a youth, you get them once, because then if you live, you build up the immunity that you would have gotten anyway with the vaccine. That's why in the old days, it's like when we were first starting to wheel out the chickenpox vaccine, the question was, hey, have you had chickenpox before? Because if you did, well, there's no reason to vaccinate you. You're already immune because you didn't get chickenpox twice. You got it once, and then you might have gotten shingles, but that's a whole other story. But you got the main illness once, and then you built up immunity, and you were done. And, so you would even see back in, courts are crazy. I think there was even a South Park about this. You know, someone would get, you know, chickenpox, and then all the families would get the kids together because they'd be like, let's just get this out of the way.
Oh, they still do it. I've seen, you know, requests in communities for, like, a chickenpox party.
Yeah! Okay, well, that was the South Park, and it's ridiculous. It's a South Park episode. Anyway,
wow.
That's ridiculous. Just vaccinate the kids. Anyway, most people do fine.
Chickenpox party?
I don't even want to wrap my head around it.
Where people, they invite all the kids, they want them to get chickenpox?
Yeah.
Get it out of the way, get it, kid has it, an opportune time.
That's a thing that happens?
Yeah. It happens. It's freaky. I don't understand it.
Have you ever heard of that happening, Aaron, outside of a cartoon?
No, it actually did. I mean, that's what they were making fun of. But this was I can remember when I was young, this happening, where people would be like, yeah, let's just get it out of the way. Because again, you have to own that getting chickenpox as a child was much better than getting chickenpox as an adult. My dad got chickenpox for the first time when we got chickenpox, and it was a freaking nightmare for him. And usually there's a lot of belief that having it as an adult is really bad, primarily, but almost no one would ever make it to adulthood without being exposed in some way. So it was very, very rare. Having said that, people sort of had this general belief and knowledge, so they would try to get it out of the way because it was, for the most part, a benign illness. And it's important to remember that most people who get chickenpox do just fine. The problem is that some don't. And, you know, when you're playing with a population-level disease, something that everyone's going to get, even if the mortality rate is low, you know, say in the order of, less than 1%, that still means that lots and lots of people are going to die. Because everyone's going to get it. These are not diseases that affect a tiny part of the population. They affect just about everybody at some point. And so that's why we do it. Even small mortality rates can have large effects.
A person getting whooping cough, even if they survive it and, you know, they seem fine from the whooping cough, it hurts their system going on for other things?
Majority of people know. It shouldn't hurt their immune system in the sense that, they should be fine. Now, I suppose you could take a real hit to your lungs in that case that, maybe you would have some sort of respiratory, but that would have to be pretty rare. Most of these diseases, you either, you have a real bad outcome right away or it goes on. But it shouldn't be an immunity problem.
Chickenpox.
Someone's going to call up and correct me. I don't think it leads to an immunity problem where getting the disease means that you're more susceptible to other illnesses because of your immune system later in life. It could theoretically, I imagine, hurt your lungs in such a way that it leaves you more susceptible to other respiratory illnesses, perhaps, for the rest of your life. But if your mom... If somebody is getting whooping cough at a later age and they were immunized or had it when they were young, it is likely because their immunity is just waning with time.
Listen to
this.
That's
why we're probably doing more boosters later in life.
As an alternative to chickenpox parties, I was looking this up because I never heard of this. Some parents, as an alternative to chickenpox parties, have mail-ordered lollipops allegedly sucked by infected children, as well as saliva, towels, clothes, and rags used by kids who have chickenpox.
His head's going to explode, Pete.
Huh?
Dr. Carroll's head is going to explode.
I'm speechless. I don't even know where to start with that.
Chicken pox lollipops. Jim, Texas, you're on Stand Up with Dr. Aaron Carroll.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to follow up on the psychiatry question. I'm a psychiatrist down here in Austin, and I thought Dr. Carroll handled it really well. The only added point I'd make is that folks with psychiatric illness take out substance use, they're much more likely to be victims of crime than to commit crimes.
Yep.
So this image of violent, crazy people running around is really...
You don't hear in the news about a someone who has a mental illness not being violent, because it wouldn't be news, because it's the vast majority of people with mental illnesses that are, yeah, not violent, and as the caller, the doctor says, more likely to get become the victim. And so it wouldn't be, but what we hear is that after all these shootings, we often hear it blamed on a mental illness, which creates this stereotype, this idea that people who are mentally ill are also dangerous. And it's just a tough meme, I think, to disrupt. And for a lot of people who aren't really understanding that the norm is not something that gets reported.
Well, I think also it's unfortunately because of the way, the only way sometimes people are exposed to mental illness is either through a story like that, or a story like someone who committed a horrible crime and then somehow gets off because they are defensed by mental illness, when like everybody believes they weren't mentally ill, but they use some kind of you know, legal trick to convince everybody they were not guilty by reason of insanity.
Yeah.
And so the image that everybody has in their hands is of a clever, you know, mastermind who commits crimes which are incredibly detailed and intricate and thoughtful, but then somehow escapes on a technicality, and if only we could have prevented it. That, first of all, that's not how mental illness works. And so that's not going to happen, but, you know, that makes for good stories and good movies and good TV, but it's almost, it's like apocryphal. That's just rarely what happens. What really is happening, as this doc describes, is that these people are truly ill, and they're often using substances or much more likely to hurt themselves or to be hurt by others or to be abused. And that, of course, is just as upsetting, if not more so, to family members than the idea that they might go out and commit a crime. But again, there's often nothing you can do because it is just one of those sort of American things where we are very cautious as a society about balancing individual rights and autonomy against what we think is good for society or good for others. And it takes a fairly large level of proof to take away someone's ability to make decisions for themselves.
Thank you, Dr. Jim. I hung up on him because I thought it was him that was in a cafeteria, but now it sounds like it might be you.
It's unfortunately, yes.
You're in a cafeteria?
No. I think Amy's putting away dishes.
All right. Chicken pox pie?
Oh, God. You're lying to me, I hope. Really?
No, yeah, we're just having fun now.
Okay.
Ryan, South Carolina, you're on stand-up.
Hey, Pete, how you doing?
Good. Just whipping up a chicken pox pie over here.
Yeah, that's
chicken pox lollipops.
Super scary in my household. First of all, I just want to let you know, I have called before. My daughter's first heart birthday was June 1st. She is 1 year post-transplant.
Remind us again about your daughter.
My daughter had hypoplastic left. Her heart was couldn't sustain life because of its coronaries. She ended up having a heart event, basically a heart attack at 2 months. She got put on ECMO for 47 days. She received her heart transplant of June 1st of last year.
Unbelievable.
Glad to hear everything is going so well. Doing so well.
How is she doing?
She's doing remarkably well. We've had a few bumps in the road. We might be one of the only, or maybe the only, recorded case of our pediatrician supposedly accidentally, gave my daughter the MMR vaccine about a month and a half ago, which transplant kids aren't supposed to have live viruses. And so that was a pretty big scare, because an immunosuppressed child, instead of preventing virus measles and mumps, basically he could have potentially just given my child measles and mumps. So that was a pretty big scare, but I just wanted to was listening to the remarks on vaccinations, and I just kind of wanted to reiterate how important it is for vaccinations. I've seen some crazy people on the internet refusing vaccinations for their kids and
TV and everywhere else. Yeah.
Yeah, and TV, and I mean, these people are nuts. And you know, I just wanted to remind everybody that there is cases, many cases like my daughter out there that can't get these live viruses. So you're actually, when you don't get vaccinations, you're actually putting immunosuppressed people in danger as well, coming in contact with them, potentially, you know, being immunosuppressed, something that you or me might put us down for a week or two could cause some serious harm to an immunosuppressed person.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny because I swear to God, I pitched that exact story a number of times to lay media without mentioning any names of specific places, and they just, and it's hard to get them to want to write about vaccines where they feel like this has been covered. And I just think one of the aspects that doesn't get enough play is the altruistic one. It's the, you know, we constantly hear arguments about like, well, I'm willing to take the risk. And we don't talk about vaccines, unfortunately, in terms of, well, you're not just protecting yourself, you're protecting others. And you're also protecting sometimes others who are loved ones. One of my favorite sort of studies which illustrates this was, I think it was chickenpox, but, you know, the kids who are at most risk are very, very, very small infants. If they get varicella, especially, a newborn, that could be horrifically bad. And we don't give the vaccine until they're one. So one of the real arguments against, the vaccine was, well, they're the babies that need it. We should be giving it. You know, we can't give it to them anyway. What's the point? You know, a child who's older, why do they need the vaccine? But they did a study in New York where, as the vaccine was given out, the number of infants less than 1 year old dropped to zero. Babies who were not vaccinated against chickenpox stopped getting it and needing hospitalization because that's how it works. We were vaccinating everybody else, and the herd immunity protected the infants who couldn't get the vaccines themselves. And so the number of children admitted to the hospital for chickenpox, they went to zero. And that's just stunning and remarkable. Wow. Because you think about the fact that we're protecting very tiny babies who aren't getting the vaccines. That's one of the major reasons we need to vaccinate. But unfortunately, we don't talk about others. We don't talk about children with cancer. We don't talk about old people that, you know, grandma and grandpa, or, you know, newborn baby in the house. All of them, that's who we're trying to help.
And I do actually have one more interesting statistic that I'm not sure if it's 100% accurate that I read recently, which numbers-wise baffles my mind as far as my daughter goes. I read that worldwide there are on average, about 100 infant transplants per year. And last year my daughter was one of them. So we want to do everything in our power to keep her safe. And
where did she get her? Who was the donor? Another infant?
We don't know.
But what age was the donor?
Oh, age. The age of the donor was actually like a month younger than her. They kind of go by size. And not so much necessarily by age. But that was the purpose of our heart birthday, was not only to celebrate our daughter getting a heart, but to remember the little girl who gave up hers.
Well, I think about you and your daughter, and I remember after our call, I said, you know, I'd love to, I don't know why, but I'd love to see a picture. Could you send us a picture? I'd love to see a picture of your family.
I have got some awesome pictures, and I'll send you a picture. Remember, there's a thing in several hospitals around here called Beads of Courage, and I'll send you a picture with her beads of courage. And just think about this: when you see it, each bead represents something that was done to her, whether it is a blood draw, whether it is giving blood, a day on ECMO.
You should get a big bead for that. Jeez.
What is that? Yeah. ECMO.
ECMO, that's basically heart-lung bypass. It's a machine that functions.
It's the heart-lung machine, yeah.
Your lungs don't work, so they take all the blood out of your body and continually oxygenate it in a huge machine and then put it back in. So it's basically
exactly. And there's this machine, and it's a fine line because you have to be heparinized. See, when they come back from surgery, they come back from surgery with their chest wide open. So I've literally seen, visually, physically seen my daughter's old heart and her new heart.
Wow.
Which was rough at first, really rough at first, but see, the thing is that because of the machine, they have to be heparinized, they have to be on blood thinners, but it has to be a fine line. So the machine doesn't clot, but it has to be a fine line so they don't bleed out. Because the more they bleed out, the more they have to introduce blood products. The more they introduce blood products, the more antibodies
right.
can become, which means that her donor pile becomes smaller. And I mean, she actually had the machine actually cut off two times because of a blood clot. That's very, very scary.
The whole thing is scary, and your courage and your wife's courage and your family's courage is just amazing. And so send me a picture. StandUpWithPete@gmail.com.
@gmail.com. Yep. I will. Just remember the beads of courage. You'll be amazed how many beads this child has.
I'm looking forward to it, Ryan. Thank you so much. I'm glad that you listen and when you call. I really appreciate it. Oof. Unreal.
Yeah.
Dr. Carroll's actually a pediatrician, and he's got plenty of stories himself and has written about them. Changing gears here, though, you know what? Let me take my break right now. We'll come back with more. I want to talk to you about your piece at the New York Times, taking on Apple, which you are a huge disciple of.
Taking on Apple.
Nothing but critical of Apple computers, which is ironic and hypocritical because he owns so many of them. Yeah. Did you get a new phone yet?
No, I'm waiting for the new iPhone.
Your willpower on this. So tell people what happened with your iPhone.
My phone, the ear speaker, like if when you hold up the phone to talk, the little speaker is broken, so I cannot use it like a normally functioning phone anymore.
So the headphones, you can talk, have a conversation with the headphones.
I can have a conversation with headphones or Bluetooth or even like if I plug in, headphones or the car, but I cannot, if I'm just walking around and the phone rings, I have to answer on speakerphone or I can't answer at all.
And I guess that's not the worst thing in the world, but I think I think I would get it fixed.
Well, these are all first world problems, but I don't want to put any money into it.
You have so much money.
First of all, that's...
Come on, you have 90 jobs.
Well, yeah, but lots of them don't pay that much. Anyway, this is not about me and the
work
money.
Work for the New York Times.
Fixing an iPhone is always like such a huge part. It's like they charge you an arm and a leg just to do anything to it. So I'm just sticking it out. I'm going to make it. I'm due for an upgrade, and the second that new iPhone comes out, that's what
I'll... Why don't you get the Amazon phone?
Because I really want the iPhone. This is the thing is I don't hate Apple.
Hate Apple, and we'll tell everybody why you hate Apple and why you attacked Apple Computer's new health app when we come back. We'll be right back with @AaronECarroll.
He's no nonsense, speaks his mind, says what you're thinking, and other horrible cliches. Stand up with Pete Dominic.
Indy, Sirius XM 104.
All right, it's Wednesday, the third hour of Stand Up. So we talked to the great Dr. Aaron Carroll, who's on Twitter @AaronECarroll, sorry, 2 R's, 2 L's. Check out his new videos at Healthcare Triage. Takes on the healthcare system of Singapore, which is very interesting. We might get to that in our conversation. But he's also contributed to the New York Times Upshot, and he has an article titled "The Trouble with Apple's Health App." He writes, "Let me be clear about one thing. I love information technology. I'm an early adopter of all kinds. I own an iPhone and many other Apple products. I've also received many grants and published many papers on the use of mobile technology for chronic disease management. I'm as pro-IT and pro-mobile technology as they come. Yet, you're very skeptical of this app. What's going on?"
I'm very skeptical of this kind of announcement or this kind of excitement actually translating into, much in the way of changes to the way that we practice.
What are we talking about?
So this is a lot, for years, and I mean years, because, I got my first grant to do this kind of stuff back in like 2004. People would say, oh my God, now that everybody's carrying around technology, everyone's got mobile technology, if everybody could just, these devices could keep track of information and send it to doctors and we could do all this mobile and outside, management of chronic diseases, and it'll be this unheralded new age of awesomeness where, we can monitor people with diabetes, their glucose values, and we can check people's blood pressure, and we can check people's weight, and we can check people's activity, and all of this information can then be sent to the doctors, and they will be able to make even better decisions about how things are going to go, and it's going to be awesome. And I am totally skeptical that any of that is going to occur, even after Apple's announcement, you know, like a week or two ago. No matter how many articles I read telling me that a new age was upon us, I remain very skeptical.
Why?
Well, there's lots of reasons why, but the first is that you got to own, you know, that we need major. The first is the things we have. We've discussed before on this station about, you know, the way that we transmit data. It is not that we lack the technology to move data from point A to point B. We know how to do that. It's very easy. We're doing it right now over the phone, over satellite. It's very easy. The problem is that we have built a system where we have made it by design impossible to share data between different kinds of systems, because that is how it works out best for the systems that make electronic health records and everything else, because if you buy one component, they want you to have to buy all their components. They don't want their stuff to talk from their system to the other system, because then you might go to the other system. So Apple made an announcement that they're working with Epic, which is like one big company. Well, those are two companies which are both very well known for keeping their data housed in secret and not shareable with others. Apple doesn't necessarily allow all their data to go, you know, up and back to other kinds of phones and stuff like that. And Epic certainly doesn't allow their stuff to go to CERN or to any other kinds of systems. So, you know, you're talking about nothing has changed with respect to the ways that we share data globally. That's just the first problem. The second problem is that who uses iPhones? You know, who doesn't have iPhones in general? Probably the elderly. Lots of very poor people, maybe a lot of the chronically ill. Those are the people we need to reach the most. And so the people who are most excited about this are likely the people that need the least amount of help with respect to outside chronic disease management. And then that's only the technological problems. The Chuck Friedman, who is a very, very well-known sort of, you know, giant in informatics and in health information technology, wrote a paper in the last decade in the Journal of the American Medical Informatics Association, and he basically postulated what he called the, you know, fundamental theorem of health informatics. And the idea was, it was a few simple equations, but, you know, the kind of thing we got to think about. One was that the idea that a human plus an information resource is better than the human alone. And everybody believes that to be true. But one of the corollaries that everybody ignores is that the human is more important than the technology. And this is what gets constantly ignored. We get super excited about technological changes, but we ignore the human aspect. People, and I've done research on this, people don't necessarily like to share their health data. In fact, it's the people who are most ill who are the most guarded about sharing their health data.
Why? If it's anonymous, wouldn't it be anonymous?
This way. Well, no, of course it's not anonymous. And I'm not talking about security purposes. I take care, much of my research was in adolescents with diabetes. Well, guess what? Adolescents with diabetes, they don't want everyone to know every glucose reading, because they don't want their high glucose value to prevent them from being able to play a sports game. They don't want their low glucose value to prevent them from going to a party. They are already often gaming the system and tricking the numbers, because people who watch their – this goes back to even the mental health stuff we were talking before. People don't want to be controlled.
But how would they be controlled if people if that information was known?
Well, let's say, okay, because right now, no, let's say that everybody doesn't know their value. Let's say you're a 15 or 16-year-old kid, and now every single glucose reading you get goes to the doctor, and anytime they see a concerning value, it's going to flag the parent. Can you imagine how quickly those kids will stop using those devices? Because now they're going to get in trouble. Now they're going to get yelled at or something taken away if one glucose value goes bad. What about adults who, you know, we can't get adults to do what we tell them to do with respect to exercise or eating already. As soon as it starts with a daily flag telling you you're not walking enough, do you know how quickly they're going to stop using those devices? The only people that would continue to use them are the people that don't need them, who want just positive reinforcement about how awesome they are.
Like your Fitbit.
Right, but again, it's like no one else, again, if every day I was, well, see, you don't do it enough, but if every day somebody was saying to me, like, you suck, and it was my doctor or someone in authority, or you're not doing enough, I'd get angry, because I'm doing the best that I can. But even then, that's the people part. The biggest roadblock is the physicians themselves, and this is not an evil. No doctor, none, have the time or the inclination to know every single glucose value of every single patient that they have. They don't want to know the weight of every single patient that they have every single day. They don't want to know the daily activity. They are already inundated with information. There was a study not long ago that shows that 1 in 3 doctors have already reported that they have already missed an important lab value or some sort of result for a patient, something that would have changed their practice for that patient because of data overload. They're getting so much stuff already that they can't sift through it to find the stuff that it's real. And so the next step would be, and this is what we tried to do in our research, let's create systems that comb through that data and then just alert physicians for things that they need. And we did these in small studies of, like, let's say 20 adolescents or 10 adolescents. But it takes an enormous amount of time, even if you put up a flag and say, hey, you know what, this kid's blood glucose readings are bad the last day or two. Somebody should get in contact with them. Tracking them down, changing their management, doing all that, that turned out to be a full-time job of a nurse practitioner, just for like 10 or 20 kids. It takes an enormous amount of time to get someone on the phone to do this. It would require doctors' offices to create massive infrastructure to try to comb through this data and use it. It's not the kind of thing that you could just do on the fly. Doctors aren't going to sink that kind of money into something that, first of all, very few patients are going to use to begin with, that they could start or stop using at all. And it would require whole new ways of practicing without any kind of help from the outside world. And again, it's not a technological problem. It's a people problem. It's how do we use it? How do we get people to change their behavior? How would doctors practice differently? They don't want to. They hate EHRs already.
Electronic health records.
You have to remember that, yeah, you have to remember that RAND study from just last year that showed, you know, one of the top reasons that doctors are miserable, it's not malpractice, it's not because they're bitching about their salary or all the things we talk about. One of the most common reasons, if not the most important reason for physician dissatisfaction in practice today is that they hate their electronic medical records so much that it makes them miserable.
Why? Because of the information overload.
That and because it forces them to change. I put up a ton of links in the New York Times piece. I encourage people to go read it at the bottom there. All the prompts, they're expensive. They're hard to use. They don't function like they're supposed to. They can get in the way of the doctor-patient relationship. They can actually cause increases.
How did they get in the way of the doctor-patient relationship?
Great picture, because often when you're in the waiting room, they expect you to constantly be entering data. And now instead of talking to the patient, looking them in the eye, your doctor is looking at the screen and typing into what he's doing. And her brain is more focused on the typing and the reading than on actually speaking to you.
So
this has been documented. I mean, this isn't studies. This is not my like personal hobby horse or whim. You know, they've done studies in the room and they've talked to patients afterwards, and patients get upset when doctors are looking at the screen. Doctors get upset when doctors
really
look at the screen. Yeah. Huh. I mean, these are like, you know, again, we assume these things are unequivocal good. And coming from, again, I am no Luddite. I love this stuff. This is what I do.
Yeah.
That's why
it's surprising that you hate it so much.
Yeah, well, thank you. I got some nice tweets yesterday from people who just assumed that. I don't hate this stuff. I love this stuff. I believe the potential for improved quality is massive. But I think that it will require major structural changes to the way that we practice, or we need to find holistic ways to incorporate this stuff into practice that doesn't do more harm than good. But I think the number one thing, and I've said it on the show before, that has to happen is the communication, the ability to transmit the data globally, to share it. That is where the potential comes from. And until we fix the standards, until we make it so that it is absolutely painlessly easy to get your data from point A to point B to be able to be used by any system or any physician, the rest of this is just window dressing. That, you know, Apple can create their thing with Epic all they like. They're not the first to do this. They certainly won't be the last. But as long as it is a closed system that only works for a certain number of people with a certain number of EHRs with a very tiny percentage of doctors, it's not going to move the needle. It just can't. Doctors are not going to change their practice, their entire way they do it, or invest significant resources for a couple percentage of patients who may or may not need this stuff already. It's just not going to happen. And we've been trying. We do it with high-risk adolescent patients in endocrine clinics where this makes absolute utter sense for this population, and still the results are modest success at best. It's difficult, it's expensive, it's hard to do.
What is your personal hobby horse, by the way?
Oh, I have a few. Milk Industrial Complex, you know, that's one of them.
yeah. I wanted to ask you about this. You sent me an email yesterday. The subject was privatize the VA? And it was a link to Andrew Sullivan's blog, where he had aggregated a number of different opinions. And generally, this is in reference to the bill to reform the VA that Senator Sanders and Senator McCain, I think, co-sponsored and passed by an almost unanimous vote. It's in the House right now. But this, the analysis of their proposal, I mean, is it about their proposal? Well,
the reason I sent it to you is because it very much mirrored what we were talking about last time, and it sort of gave it up. It was like, yeah, we can privatize it, but it's going to cost a fortune.
Right.
Like, that was the big point. It's like, privatizing is an option. Putting all of these people, veterans, instead of into the VA, we could absolutely put them into the private healthcare system that we've got going on, and that would be fine, but it had a price tag attached to it of an enormous amount of money. It would be more expensive than the Medicare Part D program, which, of course, covers the drug program for all the elderly. And it's like, that's the problem here. Nobody wants to acknowledge the fact that it's like the reason things are the way they are in the VA is because it is cheap and because we don't want to spend more money. You could sink that amount of money into the very public system and get massively better results. It's not the public-private. It's the fact that it's cheap. And, you know, people are like, well, let's just privatize it. It's like, okay, come up with the $500 trillion or whatever it's going to take to do that. And they don't want to do that. They just think magically, oh, private is going to be better. Well, one of the ways that private is often better is because it costs much, much, much more money. There's no magic to this. And so with people who are saying, well, just put them in, let them go to regular doctors, I'm always like, okay, then you've got to pay for that. But then there's like, well, I don't want to do that. Well, then you have to have what it is. This is all about trade-offs.
The proposal, though, I mean, it passed in the Senate. It's not been made law, but, I mean...
Did it pass in the Senate or the House? I didn't actually...
The Senate.
Oh, well, that's impressive, actually. Okay.
Yeah, well, it's not as impressive as something getting through the House, but...
No. But usually privatization, I would imagine that would have an easy... I mean, I would imagine, say, hey, we're going to scrap the VA and privatize it would be something. But, of course, maybe they will buck at the price tag.
Well, the general argument about anything, you know, when it comes to these issues, is that the government can't do anything. It's inefficient.
Right.
Let the private sector do it. They can do it better. They have the profit motive, and there's competition.
And again, all of those, all of those may or may not be true. I would take issue. But even that is not the problem. The reason that we, you know, if Congress in its infinite wisdom said, we believe that the VA is not functioning as it is, and we would rather put all of these people into the private system and let them get subsidies and do whatever else and give them all the money they need and everything else. And then a CBO projection showed that it would cost $500 trillion, and they said, we don't care, we're going to raise taxes. So be it. I don't know. But for me, efficiency is not defined by the outcome. Efficiency is defined by how, you know, cheaply we can get the outcome. And there's a lot of evidence that the VA may not be, you know, getting the outcomes in terms of access that everybody wants, but it's certainly doing it cheaply, and cheaply is a major part of efficiency. The video I did in the United Kingdom, their healthcare system just recently, we could have a discussion about, you know, they're not probably the best in terms of outcomes. There are other countries that often do better on sort of disease management and preventing mortality than them. But there's a good argument to be made that England is one of the most efficient healthcare systems around because they achieve decent outcomes on a shoestring. And that is what we talk, that's what we mean by efficiency. Not best, but efficient. And there's no question that the VA does things cheaply. And that's a major component of efficiency. The private sector may do it better in the long run, but there's no absolute reason to believe it does it more efficiently.
Let me ask you about, you're familiar, I only got 2 minutes here, but we haven't been talking about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and it seems like neither is the media. Obviously, there's a number of other huge issues that are exploding all over the world, literally. But the one thing I thought was interesting is that there's a, Arkansas or Texas on the border there, where one half of the town has a Medicaid expansion and the other half does not. And literally, you know, on one side of the street, they have health care and one side. Can you just quickly explain that?
Yeah, it's like Texarkana, where it's just like there's a town that almost crosses the line. And so if you live on one side and you're a resident of Texas, there's no Medicaid expansion. If you live on the other side, it's Arkansas, and there is. And so you could be in the exact same boat, have every bit about your life be exactly the same, but on one side you're getting basically free health care, and on the other side you're getting nothing and probably have less services because Texas has some of the highest levels of poverty and the lowest levels of services around. So it's a tragedy. I mean, it made the newspaper because it's a nice story about the tragedy, but this stuff is writ large. It's not just in Texas, Arkansas, or Texarkana. In states that don't have the Medicaid expansion, people making less than the poverty line have nothing. There is no program to help them. And so people making 130% of the poverty line, they get basically close to free insurance. People who are poor get nothing. And it's a crazy, ridiculous tragedy, but that is what is occurring in states that refuse the Medicaid expansion.
What do you think of my I'm on day two of my transcendental meditation workshop training.
You tell me how it's working for you.
I so far so good. I meditated twice, but there's science behind this stuff now, right?
There's also almost no harms. Remember, for me, it's all about benefits and harms. And if
right.
There's almost no harms, and if you are achieving a benefit, then I'm all for it. Now, if you ask me to start putting huge amount of taxpayer monies or people's premiums into paying for it, we might get a quibble because then I'm going to demand some hard outcomes. But for people making personal decisions, there's no harms almost. And
but isn't there I've heard about some of it and science. Isn't there a lot of good hard science behind the benefits of different forms of meditation?
I don't know. You'd have to send me that. I've not seen what I would call hard science. There's, lots of little studies that are not well controlled and things like that. And, of course, there's going to be a huge bias in all these kinds of studies because the people that would choose to do this are people that are going to believe it. And absolutely a belief in it and a willing to commit is going to be correlated with any kind of effects that you might get from it. So it would take a pretty well-designed study to start proving that there were hard outcomes. Having said that, if you've got one that you believe exists, send it to me. I'm happy to read it.
I don't know. I haven't really.
But again, if this is providing you a benefit, who cares what anybody else thinks? It has almost no harms. It's your time. It's your money. It's your whatever. And if it provides you a benefit and it's not hurting you or anyone else, why not?
Have you ever tried anything like that?
No. I can't really say that I've committed to trying anything like that. But it's.
Do you ever slow down?
Yeah, but see, that's why I read a ton. Sometimes I think it's when I'm like reading or playing a video game, that is for me sort of unplugging. You know, Legos, I swear to God, you make fun of my Star Wars Legos, but when I'm like the 2 or 3 weeks that I spend putting one of those things together, that's all I'm thinking about. I find that very therapeutic.
It's funny, we ended the show the same way we started it. So if you're listening live, we had right into the replay and Alfred, Melanie, and Chris talk about what they do. And as Dr. Carroll just mentioned some of what he does. Thank you very much for your time. As always, we appreciate it, sir.
Anytime.
Give him a follow at Aaron E. Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll.